Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. You know, October is my favorite month here in the desert. It feels like the islands some days here. This weekend, we've had thunderstorms, so it's kind of cool outside. The air is still moist, and everything kind of slows down just a little bit in Las Vegas. Perfect for our purposes tonight. We have subjects and guests tonight that are both entertaining and weighty. Both will challenge what you think you know about two very different subjects. In the second half tonight, a story that involves incredible acts of heroism, treachery, incompetence, and sheer terror. It is the true story of the worst disaster in U.S. naval history, the sinking of the USS Indianapolis. It's taken more than 50 years for the full story to emerge from behind an official wall of secrecy and blame. Two remarkable journalists have worked for years to tell the whole story, and I was totally blown away by their book. It takes you right there into the water with these sailors as they struggle to survive shark attacks and the elements for days and days. Wow, what a story. Co-authors Lynn Vincent and Sarah Vladek will be here to share what is already a runaway bestseller of a book. But first, I had hinted last month when Dave Politis was here that he had something else in the works. I'm not sure when the guy sleeps, but he returns to the program coming up in just a few minutes, and in a sense, he is returning to his roots. You know, the first time he was on Coast to Coast, I believe, was 10 years ago to discuss his first book, The Hoopah Project. It was a typical Dave Politis boots-on-the-ground investigation, this time of the Bigfoot legend, and Dave had spent 2 years among the Hoopah tribe to hear their tales and legends and to apply police and forensic methods to figure out what was being seen in the forests of the Pacific Northwest. As it turns out, of course, similar sightings have been reported all over the world. And while Dave is better known these days for his investigations of missing people, he's never stopped thinking about or working on the Bigfoot mystery. And tonight he's back with a book that's a great resource for anyone interested in this subject. It traces the Sasquatch story through newspaper reports and historical records. That name Bigfoot has been around, as we know, since 1958, but the big guy himself has been around much longer than that. These stories go way, way back, centuries, along with related stories of wild men and giants. And we're happy to welcome Dave back to the program to talk about his original investigation and where it's led. That's coming up momentarily. Webmaster Lex and I have pulled together our usual assortment of items and oddities, culled from various media sources. We call it Knapp's News. You can find it on the Coast to Coast AM website. You know, since Halloween is just around the corner, we have a story about urban legends, some of them that turn out to be true, sort of, 11 of them anyway. Also, election season has arrived. Early voting is underway, at least here in Nevada. Plenty of discussion about the use or misuse of social media, how it warps elections or might warp elections. Well, here's something else to worry about, something called deepfake technology. Pretty good chance it might be headed our way one of these days if it's not here already. A flip side to that chilling report is a funny bit about artificial intelligence and how goofy it looks when it has tried to tell people's fortunes, writing as if it's like a fortune cookie or something. The Washington Post had a fun piece about that kind of experiment. And then we have a story about something long overdue. NASA finally says the next rover it launches to Mars, it wants this thing to look for signs of life. Really? Really? That's just now occurred to NASA. Maybe while we're up there on Mars, maybe poke under a rock or two and search for life. Better late than never, I suppose. Those stories and more in tonight's Knapp's News. And while you're on the Coast website, check out how to become a Coast Insider. You can subscribe. It's about 15 cents a day for an annual subscription, and you gain access to a vast archive of previous programs. You can listen to anytime you want, as often as you want. Plus, you can find out how to subscribe to George Norrie's television program, Beyond Belief, which is a lot of fun, features interviews with guests well-known to the listeners of this program. Now with that, let's assume the position. Bring in the dog and cat and maybe your pet rooster too. Put on a pot of Joe, slip into those flannel jammies and the bunny loafers, plop down in a comfy spot, turn down the lights and turn up the radio, because we're about ready to rumble. In a moment, David Politis, Bigfoot, Wild Men, and Giants. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. My first guest is well known to Coast audiences for his groundbreaking work on what's become a wildly successful and respected investigative project, the Missing 411 series of books and a documentary film by that title. In fact, Dave Politis was here last month to talk about the latest in that series. He's broadened his web, his net, and his focus again. The popularity of those books has overshadowed his original project, the one that got him on the path of pursuing missing persons cases. 10 years ago next month, Dave made his first appearance on this program with me to talk about the Hoopa Project, a groundbreaking investigation into the Bigfoot mystery in which Dave applied many of the techniques and strategies he learned as a police officer to the Sasquatch legend. He immersed himself in it, lived among the Hoopa people of Northern California, and employed the talents of a forensic sketch artist to give accurate portrayals of what people have been seeing for a very long time. Well, he may have been focusing on missing 411 for the last few years, but never lost interest in Bigfoot. So here he is with a new work. It's an archive of Bigfoot and wild man stories and news reports dating all the way back to the year 1680. And while I think Dave is probably not likely to take a position on what the answer to the mystery might be, he has pulled together a pretty amazing collection of reports from eyewitnesses, newspapers, journalists, hunters, and others who've seen these creatures up close and personal. Dave Politis, welcome back.
Hey, George, thanks again for having me.
Absolutely.
We've had some good times on the show, and I appreciate it.
So returning to work on Bigfoot, does this feel like you're dating your ex?
it's kind of odd. Just, like you said, it's always been stewing in the background, and it's something that's always had my interest. I think it's an elusive topic that... there's a lot of conjecture out there, but not a lot of facts.
You never stopped working on it, did you? I mean, your focus may have been elsewhere, but it's always been sort of you kept an eye out for articles and information.
You know, I can't say that I've committed much energy to it in the last, say, 7-8 years and focused on missing people. But when you're going through the archives and you're trying to pull out articles about missing people, I'm always reading about all kinds of things that I see on these first pages of news articles and such. And I started to come across these stories about something that looked like Bigfoot when you read the articles, but when you read the title, it, like 90% of the time, it'll say Wild Man. And I hadn't done a lot of archived work on the topic before, but, you know, 8 years of digging through these archives for missing people articles, I just started to pull them and put them in a folder. And over the years, it got large. And eventually I said, you know, this is pretty intriguing. I think even if you're an optimist or a pessimist on the topic, it's convincing that something over the years has been around us and has been documented. And it shows this historical aspect that most people don't understand.
We're going to get into the specifics articles about Bigfoot, Wild Men, and Giants, and sometimes they're the same and sometimes they're different. But I wanted to, just for those who were not listening 10 years ago when you were first here, can you recap the Hoopa Project, how you got started on that, what you learned, and how it kind of got its hooks into you all these years later?
So I never had a dog in the fight. I was working for a technology company. I was getting ready to retire and raise a couple kids, and two of the guys I was working with that were super wealthy came to me, and they sat me in this room, and they told the story that independently, without knowing each other, when they were kids, they had a Bigfoot encounter in the mountains of the Sierras. And they found each other later in business, and in a weird sort of set of coincidence, they started talking about Bigfoot, and they found each other and were shocked that they each had a similar encounter. And they said, you know, Dave, you have 20 years as a police officer, you have years of investigating in HR, you're the guy really to give it that independent look. We'll finance it, you go about it at your own pace, we know you have your kids to raise, but help us out with this. We really want to find out. And initially I said no, and they kept coming back, and they said, at your own pace, you can do it. So I went about looking for an area that had a few things. First of all, I wanted internet. I needed a hotel. And I knew that there was Native American history with a topic that ran deep. And I needed it within, say, 6 to 8 hour driving location from where I lived at the time in Los Gatos, California. And I cordoned down the area to Hoopoe, which is about 30 miles south of Bluff Creek, where the Patterson-Gimlin film was made in 67. So I started to do some geographical research, some topographical, some weather, and I started to bring this together. And then I went up there and made contact with the Hoopoe police. So they had a police background. I approached them and I said, hey, maybe you can break down some doors for me. I'm not going to stretch the truth. I'm going to tell the truth. And every witness that comes forward, they're going to have to write an affidavit to what they saw under penalty of perjury. And I wanted to raise the bar on the topic a little bit so that there would be no question about what was stated because they'd sign it. And there'd be no question about if the story was fabricated because it was done under perjury. So I started that route, and a couple of the cops there knew many of the elders, and this was so helpful in breaking down the doors. These guys would introduce me and they'd say, hey, you can trust this guy. He's a friend. He's credible. And that's the way it got started. And after I heard maybe 10 or 15 of these stories from ultra credible people in and out of the tribe, one was a store manager that ran this big store in Hoopoe that lived miles away who saw one coming into town. I started to think about my police days, and I used to work with a forensic artist that was just phenomenal. And he would sit down with a witness, be able to draw the sketch from just the witness statements, and the results were amazing. But I wanted something a slightly different so I could align this person with a tribal setting and Native Americans. And I found a diamond, unbelievable luck. An individual named Harvey Pratt, who was assistant director of the Oklahoma Bureau of Investigation and the chief forensic artist, FBI trained for the state of Oklahoma. And Harvey's not only a world-famous artist, he's an outstanding law enforcement person. And Harvey and I met, and right away we just clicked like brothers. And when Harvey would sit down with, say, a witness to a robbery and draw the sketch of the suspect, and the suspect was later caught, I swear to you, it is like the suspect was in the room and Harvey drew the sketch of the suspect. That is how accurate this man is. And so when I brought him in to the Native American tribe, they immediately accepted him because he's a Cheyenne Arapaho Native American chief. He's got a law enforcement background, so he can kind of smell bullshit when it happens. And Harvey and I have done this for a long time now together, and we're best friends. We did two books, The Hoopoe Project, and then we did a follow-up book called Tribal Bigfoot, where we went outside of Hoopoe and draw sketches of what other people saw. Again, took statements under penalty of perjury, and kind of how it started.
You said you don't have a dog in the fight, meaning you're not committed to one position or another because there are several different camps in the Bigfoot world, right?
Oh, bingo. When I started, the most vocal, the most audacious, the most vulgar are probably the people who believe it's an ape. And they will run you over, they will demean you, they will do anything to push that cause. But since they were the most outspoken, I thought, well, this must be true. And I kind of went down that path thinking, well, it must be an ape, it must be some kind of ape background. But I still kept that open mind. And when the first day that we sat down with the people in and around Hoopoe and drew the sketches, Harvey, myself, and Harvey's wife, Gina Pratt, also an agent in Oklahoma, we were sat in stunned disbelief because the sketches were very human-like. Yeah, they were huge. Yeah, they had hair all over the body. But there was this human quality that you just couldn't miss. And they didn't look like apes. They didn't have that ape characteristics that you would think of in a face, in a chest, et cetera. And it was just shocking. And when the witnesses saw the sketches, to a lady and to a man, they would consistently say, Harvey, you nailed it. That is exactly what you look like. And when you talk to the elders, they would consistently say, this is another tribe of people. These aren't animals. These are people.
They had sort of developed a relationship with them, or at least a coexistence, right?
Yeah, in the tribal area, I met one of the managers, presidents, chairman of the tribe, and they said, they looked at a map, and they said, so this is their area. We don't go in there. And this is your area. This is our area. And if they can come into our area, and they do regularly, and that's why we see them. But the one thing about the Hoopa area is the Trinity River, a great salmon and steelhead area, has just so much wildlife. And if you drive through Hoopa from Willow Creek, you'll notice that there are more berry bushes on the roadways in the surrounding mountains than I've ever seen anywhere in the world. And there's this association with berries and Bigfoot over the years that if you pay attention and you do the research, there's something about that. And I know that they're seen eating it a lot, but it's just an odd coincidence.
Can you, I don't want to go too deep into the woods, literally and figuratively, but can you summarize, as a lawman, as a former lawman, the state of the evidence about this, whether you'd say is there sufficient evidence that something is real here that we just haven't quite figured out?
So several years of walking down that path, I knew that DNA is the real answer to any solution of animal life or human life. And there were a series of people that I met on this journey that were absolutely ultra credible. Many of them didn't want to talk about it. Many of them didn't want to be visible about it. But all of them said, yeah, we're in on this. Let's get the DNA. And George, I got to thank you that many years ago, you brought on, and at my request, a PhD named Melba Ketchum. And Dr. Ketchum was one of the few people in the world that was willing to go into the lab and DNA test the hairs, tissue, blood, et cetera, that we'd bring in. And on your show, we said, hey, we need other samples from throughout North America to test to kind of get a cross-section of what we're dealing with. And that led to 110 samples being submitted. Many of them were hair. And with the hair, you need the follicle to get the mitochondrial DNA. And then other people came forward with a tissue sample, blood, saliva, and all of this Melba worked through incredibly well to figure out the solution and the chemical way to extract and read this DNA. And the amazing part is that we got nuclear DNA. And what this showed was that the biped went back 12 to 15,000 years on the female side to the Arab region, to Jerusalem, to Jordan, into that part of the world. And this is when it was sent to GenBank, and 352 billion base pairs of human DNA is in this. And unbelievably, GenBank came back and said they can't find ever reading the male side of the equation. And they wrote this up. She brought in three other PhDs, super smart people, to help her write a white paper about this. And during that process of getting the DNA, extracting the DNA, one of the places that they used was the Louisiana Crime Lab, a completely automated process for extracting the DNA and getting it. And there was no way that these samples could have been compromised. Yet, as the paper was written, before I get there, so they write, as they're in the process of writing the paper, a lot of people don't know this, but you and I worked together to introduce Melba to a very brilliant scientist who had written white papers before. And we explained to her, and he explained to her, a proper way to go about this. She listened to some of this, but she didn't listen to all of it. And unfortunately, she put a lot of feelings and thoughts that don't belong in a white paper. But if you abstract all of those feelings and thoughts and you stick strictly with the science, which people don't, and 99% of the people have never read the paper and they read little news briefs here and there and think it's the truth, the reality is that when you sit with a scientist who reads that science behind the paper, they know that those 110 samples tell a story that's phenomenal.
When we come back, we're going to get into that a little bit more and then jump into specifics from Dave Politis' new book, Bigfoot, Wild Men, and Giants. We're talking with David Politis about his new book, Bigfoot, Wild Men, and Giants, archived articles 1680 to 1922. There are hundreds of them, hundreds of credible stories about different creatures that look sort of like an animal and look sort of like a man, close-up encounters, including some famous people. And we're going to hear some of those stories in a moment. We're going to continue our conversation about the DNA evidence that Dave Politis helped to uncover with Melba Ketchum in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. We're talking with David Politis about Bigfoot, Wild Men, and Giants, the newest book, an archive of articles that go way back to 1680, describing these creatures, people, whatever you want to call them. And before the break, Dave was explaining how he and some colleagues had collected a whole bunch of samples, dozens and dozens of samples that were submitted to very precise DNA kind of testing. The paper that was written by Dr. Melba Ketchum maybe had some personal observations that didn't belong in the paper, but the DNA evidence, David, was rock solid, right?
Well, that's the part that I don't think a lot of people understand. This wasn't some half-ailed treatment. It was the best of the best. The DNA was sent to 4 certified labs, so to ensure that there was no mistake. All of the labs got the same results. It was analyzed by a series of people. It went through so many hurdles, it was unreal. There's a couple of outsiders right now doing research on DNA, and you can see them on TV, and they said, oh, you know, the DNA's come back as bears, et cetera. And one of the things that Melba did that most researchers and DNA so-called experts are not doing right now is that when the hair samples came in, they went to a hair and fiber expert before they went to DNA to ensure that they came back as Bigfoot hair. Now, people are going to say, well, how do you know that's Bigfoot hair? Well, Bigfoot hair looks different than any other mammal hair in the world. And I could teach anybody in 5 minutes to look at a Bigfoot hair and tell the physical difference under a microscope between that and other hairs. Hair and fiber experts have a graph of all the different mammal hairs in North America. And when you look at a Bigfoot hair, it's entirely different. So if the hair didn't jump through that hurdle, it never went on to DNA. But if you pay attention, all of these DNA experts are not using a hair and fiber expert to even look at and ensure that what they're dealing with is the real deal. So, and I don't think some of these so-called DNA experts have figured out the formula that Melba did to extract this DNA and to get the results. And there's a lot of attitude in this arena, as you know, George, and it's unfortunate that people won't put down their defenses and all work together. And it almost seems at times that there's something else behind the scenes that's ensuring that they don't want to get those results.
Well, it's kind of like the UFO world. I mean, people are very passionate, but they're also very turf conscious, and you have a certain element of people who take their passion to different levels, to the point of fraudulent material, and will stab people in the back and will sabotage others. The DNA evidence, at a minimum, people were able to dismiss it because it has elements of humans in it, right? So they'd say, well, it's human, but it's not all human.
No, and that's the part. The best I could say is it looks like it's a hybrid human. It's unusual, but it's way far down that human spectrum. I think the most unusual part that everyone was stunned about was that the nuclear DNA couldn't come back with a human match on GenBank. And when you look at that, you've got to think, well, that means number one, that GenBank has never had a sample in the world submitted other than ours. And how could that be? We sat down as a group many times and tried to be smart about how we got this DNA. And luckily, on a couple of occasions, a farmer had some pipes break, an irrigation pipe, and it was kind of surmised that, say, a 6-foot section of pipe was purposely broken on each end 6 feet apart, because it appeared that a Bigfoot was trying to get some kind of animal that was in the pipe, some kind of rodent or something. And when it broke the PVC pipe, it bled on it. Well, we got the DNA off that. Other times, it licked a game camera. We got that. And there was a tissue sample. We got that. And then over 100 hair samples that had a follicle that all matched this Bigfoot look when you view it under a microscope. Now, 99.9% of the time, when I get approached about this, the people haven't read the study. They've read a newspaper article or someone's opinion, and they believe it. And they refuse to get into the minutiae of the data and read the report, because it's available online, and see that the hurdles that we went through to make sure that this was true and accurate. I give all the credit to Melba. She's a genius scientist that figured this out. It's unfortunate.
Yeah, because it got kind of thrown under the bus, as she did as well. You said that this was not in GenBank. Is it now, or did they toss it out?
They wouldn't take it.
Let's go to your book, Bigfoot, Wild Men, and Giants. I mean, a lot of times these descriptions, and there's some amazing work in here. There's some really tremendous writing in some of these old articles from a long time ago, but and some of them are pretty hilarious in writing it off and making fun of the witnesses as well. But these things, the three different categories that you have in the title, they're all sort of blended together, although there are some very important distinctions between the three, and they go way, way back, 1680. How did you find all these?
So again, it was just me searching for old cases on missing people that seemed to fit that profile that we were looking for. But then when I had this giant stack of articles, kind of the breakdown of the way the articles were worded is 202 of the articles used wild man as a description, 24 used ape, gorilla, or monkey, 98 used giants, and 40 used something else. Now, the articles, the way they broke down on geographical, is 158 were in the U.S., 16 in Canada, 3 in Hungary, 3 in the Himalayas or Nepal, and 3 in the U.K. Now, there were others, but those were the bulk of them. And then the states with the most articles about it were Ohio with 21, Pennsylvania 13, California 11, Indiana 11, New York 9, Georgia 9, Kentucky and Texas 6, and then the numbers keep going down from there. But again, I wasn't looking for these, and they weren't associated with the missing persons articles. They just would have visibility on a front page along with an article on the missing. But I started to pay attention, and I got to give some credit to a guy named Tom Powell out of Oregon. Tom's a brilliant guy, good researcher, and he started to make the connection between giants and Bigfoot. And one of the funniest things he did in his presentations is genius. Is a lot of people say, oh, you know, if you overlay this map with the maps of Bigfoot wild man disappearances, they're all the same. And he puts up a map of like Bigfoot appearances and UFO appearances. And then he does some where, oh, you know, the amount of rain in a certain area is associated. And he goes down like six maps. And then he puts up a map and he doesn't say anything. He goes, you know what this is a map of? He goes, this is a map of all the Walmart stores in the U.S. Can you see how they're kind of associated in the same locations as the Bigfoot site? But it was his statement about giants that were found in past centuries in mounds and in excavations that really kind of got me thinking, were these giants the Bigfoot that were buried, or were these something else? And how come there aren't more giants that we can go see at museums and things. Where are they?
Yeah, I've asked that question. I'm really interested in the subject in part because there are some of those stories here in Nevada. You know, the Paiutes and Shoshone have legends and stories about Bigfoot bones or giant bones that were stashed in a cave up in northern Nevada. And you ask what happened to the bones and nobody can seem to find them.
Well, a lot of these articles pointed to some universities would get them. But the more likely candidate where all these went, and it said in the articles, was the Smithsonian. Yet nobody can go back and find them now, and the Smithsonian claims they don't have them.
You look back at some of the descriptions. There's one early in your book. It's from the Maryland Gazette, June 27, 1793, describing an encounter. A witness sees this on the South Fork of a river, an animal between 12 and 15 feet high. It's a shape resembling a human, except the head, which is in equal proportions to the body. The feet are 2 feet long and hairy. That sounds like our guy, doesn't it? I mean, the descriptions sound like modern descriptions of Bigfoot.
So when I found these articles from the 1700s, I was stunned because nobody talks about it. But when you, like one of the quotes in that article says, this animal is between 12 and 15 feet high and in shape resembling a human being, except the head, which is, like you said, in equal proportion to the body. So I'm thinking, wow, they were writing about this way back when, and nobody nowadays has ever brought this stuff up. So one of the articles I put in the Tribal Bigfoot book that nobody wants to talk about was in 1934, there was a series of trailside incidents in Washington where hikers and hunters and things were getting rocks thrown at them, and they saw this figure that looked like a Bigfoot. Well, then they went and told the sheriff, and the sheriff was going to get a posse together to go kill this thing. Well, this article came out and said that three Native American tribes got together, and they held a press conference. And they told the sheriff and they told the community, don't go kill these things. They're a different kind of tribe. They have communication. We've communicated with them, and we trade with them from time to time. But if you go into their area and you kill one of them, they'll kill three of you. And then they go in to explain that they have certain abilities that you don't understand. That you could think that you're around and maybe a coyote or a bird is right near you, when in reality, it's going to be them, and they have this incredible ability to mimic anything that they want with incredible strength and size. And when they said that they're another tribe of people, this community in the Bigfoot world that is very adamant that they're an ape throws this completely out the wall. And when you dig deeper in it, most Native American tribes, in fact, probably 99%, say it's another type of people or tribe. And this article goes right to that point. And nobody who has ever written a book before Tribal ever brought that out. And when I found it, I couldn't believe that nobody was talking about it. And it's stunning still that nobody wants to talk about it.
Yeah, I wonder what those tribes, if they're still around, would say about it now, 80 years later, 90 years
later.
Well,
I can tell you that being around tribes in the Midwest and in the West, like Harvey and I were, it's consistent. They still say that it's a type of people.
You know, the descriptions, of course, as you have noted, the term Bigfoot started in 1958. So before then, people had other words for it. And in many or most of the early clippings and stories that you have collected, they call them wild man. Well, of course, I guess that would fit. I mean, they're humanoid shape. They're out in the forest. They're hairy. They don't know what else to call them.
So it walks like a man. It walks upright. It doesn't walk bent over, and their knuckles aren't dragging on the ground like an ape. If I always tell people, I said, well, if it's an animal, then it's probably going to be found. And it's probably going to be identified, and you could probably go view it and study it. And wild man, Bigfoot, that's a different sort of thing. It's a different kind of topic. They're very elusive. I don't know anybody that's claim to have studied them in the wild, walking into the wilderness and found a spot and studied them year after year. So they have intelligence that's quite a bit different than the average animal, quote unquote, that you see in the woods. And even the animals on the ape, gorilla, et cetera, side of the equation, totally different. They act different, they walk different, they look different. And one thing that everyone has to think about is never in North America have there been any wild ape gorilla bones found, ever. But we have had wild or giant human bones found. And that should really make you think.
You know, some of the descriptions in the articles made me chuckle a little bit, because the writers, who have no familiarity with the topic, of course, because it's new to them, they're explaining it must have been old Fred so-and-so who disappeared into the forest a couple of years ago, and now he's grown hair all over his body.
I chuckled with you on those. And I think people are scratching to bring in some rationality to an irrational observation. And in the parts of the country where these things are seen, you know, get way, way below zero, it snows. How's Fred that decided to leave his farm going to live in that type of environment?
And grow hair all over his body like that, thick, long hair. You mentioned in the clip that I was reading there from the late 1700s, you had a notation at the bottom that said maybe this is what Daniel Boone saw. I didn't see the Daniel Boone story in here other than that reference that you made, but he had an encounter. It's a fairly famous encounter, right?
That's correct. And I couldn't find an archived news article about it, but I saw other secondary and third level things that were written about what Daniel called, I think it was a Yahoo.
Yeah.
And yeah. The description was pretty close, and I don't know. It sure seemed possible. But again, if you went into the quote unquote credible archives, you're really not going to find that. You have to dig really deep and find out what maybe some explorers wrote about that they heard in which he encountered. So, but again, in tribal Bigfoot, I've written about things where an explorer from the Latter-day Church was coming across country on his horse. And he wrote in his explorer notes that this thing came up to him while he's on his horse and looked him eye to eye and actually spoke to him. Large, hairy biped he had never seen before that matched this description of a wild man or a Bigfoot. And it came from the archives of the Latter-day Saint Church, and it's in there. So to say that these things haven't happened, ridiculous.
The first entry, the oldest entry, comes to us from Jacques Vallée. You wrote about it and have a clip from September 17th, 1680. It was reported in his book, Wonder in the Sky. A large black cloud-like mass landed in a field, releasing a huge hair-covered being that was seen briefly and disappeared. Now, that's the kind of thing that will drive Bigfoot people who think it's an ape just crazy.
Yeah. You know, I'm not sure how many people listening actually bought Jacques' book on about this, but when I was going through it, I like to think I'm a mile wide and an inch deep. I like to read about different things that could be associated with topics I'm doing research on. And when I read this, I almost fell over and said, wow, I don't think anybody's ever heard of this. And his book, which was a Kickstarter project,
right,
which kind of did the same thing with the UFO topic that I did on this Bigfoot topic, it was a stunner. Again, I don't think a lot of people want to hear this.
Yeah, I was part of that project and supported it, and it's a tremendous book. If people can find it anywhere, they should check it out. We're talking with Dave Politis about his latest work, Bigfoot, Wild Men, and Giants, archived articles 1680 to 1922. Great stuff packed into here. We're going to take a short break and come back, and sometime in the next hour, I'll open up the phone lines so you can join the conversation from Bigfoot to Little Feet here, taking us into the break with a song from Waiting for Columbus.